Has Rwanda broken international law by abducting an exiled dissident? I'll ask the country's justice minister. I'm Mark Lamont Hill, and welcome to a special edition of Upfront. This week's episode is a little different. I speak to Rwanda's Justice Minister, Johnston Businge, about the detention and trial of critic Paul Rusesabagina, who became famous when the story of how he saved ethnic Tutsis during Rwanda's 1994 genocide was made into the Hollywood film Hotel Rwanda. He's now on trial in Kigali on terrorism-related charges. His case made international headlines, not just because of the film, but because of how his arrest happened. The 66-year-old, who is a Belgian citizen and U.S. resident, mysteriously disappeared in Dubai in August and showed up in handcuffs in Kigali a few days later. The victim, he says, of kidnapping. The Justice Minister's team mistakenly sent up front a 1.5-hour long recording, including a practice interview the minister did with his PR team on how to answer questions about Rusesabagina's case. In the call, the minister reveals that prison authorities in Rwanda have been intercepting and reading correspondence between Rusesabagina and his lawyer, and that they had intercepted a document that tipped them off to a possible escape plan. We gave the minister the opportunity to come back on our program and discuss this, and he has accepted. We'll show you that second interview in just a bit. But first, the interview the Rwandan government wanted you to see. This week's headliner from Kigali, Rwandan Justice Minister Johnston Businge. Johnston Businge, thank you for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Rusesabagina, the well-known dissident who's been living in exile, was arrested in Kigali, the Rwandan capital, in August after he got on a plane and thought he was going to Burundi, but he ended up in Rwanda instead. How did he get there?
Well, let me make one little thing clear, that there is a case against Paul Rusesabagina in our courts. It's running, and some of the issues are part of the court case. They are sub judice. We would probably not go into the details about them. But what I know that the prosecution say is that Paul Rusesabagina arrived in Kigali voluntarily on a plane, and he was arrested by the Rwanda National Police and handed over to investigation.
You say he appeared voluntarily. Are you saying that after living in exile, viewing himself as an enemy of the state, he decided to fly to Rwanda on his own accord?
Well, the story I'm told, again, let me repeat again, there is a case going on, and I think this will be revealed in the courts of law, the interpretations of lawyers and so on. But I have been told that he had a friend who also participated in the same criminal activities as he is charged with. And then that friend was also part of the criminal investigation that was going on, and he eventually turned him in and brought him to Kigali. But the rest of it, I would want to let it be processed in the courts, because as Attorney General of the Republic, I wouldn't want to be talking about stuff which is sub judice.
Absolutely. I wouldn't expect you to delve too deeply into the specifics of an ongoing case, but I'm sure you could respond at least to what your own president, Paul Kagame, said. He referred to the operation of getting Mr. Rusesabagina there as flawless. What does that mean? What is a flawless operation in this context?
First of all, I believe that President Paul Kagame was talking about that friend of his bringing him up to Kigali. You know that he took off from his home in San Antonio, Texas, through Chicago, to Dubai, and the whole flight was flawless. I think that's what the president was talking about.
So are you suggesting, because this is where it gets interesting to me. Mr. Rusesabagina last spoke to his family in Dubai when he was in the airport. He thought he was going to Burundi to speak to pastors. Somehow, according to him, the flight lands and he's not in Burundi. He's in Rwanda, from where he's been in exile. are you saying that the government had no role in luring or tricking him to Rwanda?
Well, he is, he expects to get to Burundi, that's correct. And it's not like just because Rwanda, it's not just is out of Rwanda, a country has gone into exile out of, but it's also a country looking for him on account of crimes that he is allegedly involved in. So that is a country that most probably is looking for him. And if they, there is a possibility that a friend of his can land him in Kigali, then that makes the work of the investigation and criminal prosecution much easier. And I think that is what happened.
Right, but just so that I can get a clear yes or no from you, did the government play any role in getting him to Rwanda?
The government played a role in investigating crimes committed in the southwest of Rwanda, the terror attacks that happened.
I understand that, sir. But sir, that's not my question. My question is, did the government play a role in tricking him or luring him to Rwanda? He thought he was going to Burundi. Did the government play any role in the process that got him from that airport into Rwanda?
The government got someone who was criminally responsible, accomplice with him, and that particular individual was very close to him and volunteered to turn him in.
If he was under an impression that one thing was going to happen and yet an entirely different thing happened, that is to say, if he thought he was going to Burundi and he was tricked to coming into Rwanda for an arrest, do you see that as in line with or against international law?
It's in line with international law. It has been done before. It's a way you can, I think the United States of America has done it many times. I think it's a way you can get someone voluntarily as long as you did not grab them from anywhere.
So your position as Minister of Justice is that if a person is tricked into an arrest or tricked into traveling into a country for an arrest, that is perfectly legal. That is your position.
My position around that case is that the courts will obviously unearth many of these things, and it will be a subject of debate in the courts from the prosecution and the defense. So I would want the large part of this matter to be dealt with by the courts. I don't want to make conclusions about it. But what I say is that under international law and in practice, many countries have done this.
Would you consider this an example of enforced disappearance? The reason I ask is because the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, also known as the Convention Against Torture, says that no one is to be sent to a country where there are substantial grounds for believing that they might be tortured or mistreated. What do you make of that?
First of all, let me say that there's nothing like that that could happen, that might happen in Rwanda. Rwanda does not torture or mistreat anybody.
He says that he was bound for 3 days. He says that he's been denied access to proper medical treatment. He's scared that he's going to die of a stroke because of his high blood pressure. He has other risks. He's at risk for COVID. He says he's been denied access to his own attorneys who aren't allowed to communicate with him. If we're talking about due process, if we're talking about safety, if we're talking about medical vulnerability, it seems to me that this would satisfy the conditions of at least inhumane treatment. How would it not?
Well, I believe that that is also a story from his family. I have not heard it from his lawyer. I have not heard it from
which lawyer? Well, you say you haven't heard from his lawyer, but he's saying that his lawyers are saying that they haven't been given access to him, that he was, yes, able to pick from the list that you all gave him, but that his actual personal attorneys have been denied access to him.
But that is not correct. That is not correct. His personal lawyers have been defending him. And the ones that mischaracterized as that were given to him by government, it was not correct. When he arrived in Rwanda, the government has an obligation not to interview people without giving them access to attorneys. He chose from a list, personally choosing, and he spoke to New York Times, he spoke to the East African about this, about choosing his lawyers. And when he doesn't want them, they don't impose themselves on him. But right now, since October...
I'm sorry, you said he spoke to the New York Times. That's true. When he spoke to the New York Times, he was surrounded by armed police, correct?
I do not think so. I think there was nothing that stopped him from doing what he wanted to do. I think he spoke to the New York Times extremely freely and voluntarily.
The New York Times says they were plain clothes, but he was surrounded by police. He also was in a fog about what happened for the 3 days where he couldn't figure out where he was or how he got there. You could see how someone could at least interpret that as him being under duress.
But did you hear the story of how he talked to the New York Times about what his intentions were, how he supports what happened in southwestern Rwanda, how he says this is a wake-up call for Rwanda? He attacked so that Rwanda is woken up. Would that be a story that you tell when you're under duress? I don't think so.
I can't say, but it seems it's an interesting question, at least. Another question, of course, is his level of communication and the privacy of his communication with his attorneys. Has the sanctity of his private communication with his attorneys been protected?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. He has private communication. He has his lawyers. They visit him. He has his. He visits with his. I think you also raised the issue of his medical condition. He visits with his physician at King Faisal Hospital, and I think there is literally no problem around with legal fair trial status and his medical condition.
Okay, no, well, again, his family sent medicines to him through the Belgian embassy. They've never been given to him. Again, there are COVID outbreaks in the prison. He's obviously vulnerable. But I don't want to lose this question about the attorney. Are you, again, on the record, are you saying that the Rwandan government has not taken, intercepted, or otherwise violated the privacy of his communication with his lawyer? Is that the case?
No.
Okay.
No, it has not happened, and I would want, I would think that if that has happened, it will be raised in the court. He's been appearing in court. If it happens, it will be raised in court, and the courts will address it fairly.
Johnston Businge, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very, very much.
I spoke to the minister a second time. Here's what happened. Johnston Businge, thank you for joining me again on Upfront.
Thank you very much.
I want to ask you about the sanctity of communication between Paul Rusesabagina and his attorneys. I want to play you some sound of what you said to your public relations advisors about this.
What happened was that also, let me also say that in most jurisdictions, prisons insist on you know, finding out what is happening inside prisons, including what people have, what they are doing with it, and so on and so forth. So,
including legal documents.
Including legal documents. I think including the Mandela rules, including minimum standards of management of prisons, there are many rules that will allow you to know what's happening and what's going on in people's documents. Two, there was a document. There was a particular document, actually, in one of those activities carried out by the prison authorities. There was one particular document which actually suggested escape, which came from a child of Rusesabagina all the way to him, suggesting that they were being engaged on a possibility of getting him to escape. That one was found by the prison authorities, and also, but it was also handed back to Rusesabagina.
So, Mr. Businge, you said that documents that could be privileged are being intercepted and read by prison authorities. How can this be a fair trial if your government is reading the documents that could include Mr. Rusesabagina's defense strategy, for example?
Thank you very much. Let me clear this. The Rwanda Correctional Services is an autonomous institution that is charged with management of prisons. Secondly, it is in charge of safety and security of prisoners, of people who visit prisons, of everybody that is around the prisons, including the lawyers who come in, including workers and other staffers who pass around. And prison security and safety is a function of the Rwanda Correctional Services, as I just said. Secondly, the sanctity of defense communication between lawyers and their clients is protected by law. When anybody in the defense team of Rusesa Sabagina visits him, when they talk to him, whenever they exchange on their documentation, that is privileged and that is protected. So we have two competing functions here. On the one hand, the correctional service makes sure there is safety and security for prisoners, and it does not have to report on this, whatever they find, unless there is an element that requires them to report either in a criminal process, in a medical process, or in some other process. But
just so that I'm clear, sir, the prison is under your purview. They operate under your purview, correct?
The Ministry of Justice is the supervising ministry, yes.
So you have all the information that the prison gets about those documents, including privileged ones, can be reported to you?
No.
So who,
they are not.
Who are they reported
to? Sorry?
So who would be the recipient of those reports?
Well, they do their work about safety and security of the prison, and that's where they stop. That's the beginning, safety and security, and that's where they stop. They don't report to other institutions about what they find unless there is interest that requires other institutions' involvement, including, as I said, it might be crime, it might be medical, it might be health, whatever it is. But they do not, the law does not empower them to report what they find unless there is that kind of requirement.
Why would a legal document need to be examined? Why would a private communication between a prisoner and their lawyer be a security concern?
Well, in that case, it wouldn't have to be a security concern, but let me ask you another little hypothetical question. What if it was a complete escape? What if it was a truthful, concrete escape that was being planned? But what I'm saying is that...
I'm not asking about an escape, but I'm talking about legal communication between a prisoner and their lawyer. You specifically said legal documents, and in this case, if we see Mr. Rusesabagina's legal communication between him and his attorney, how is that a security concern?
I said the legal communication, the communication between lawyer and client is protected by law. And I want to imagine that because we have, as I told you yesterday, there is this legal process going on, I want to continue to be cautious about what pronouncements I make because I do not wish to be quoted on them and or probably be said to be influencing the court process. But I say that communication between lawyer and client is absolutely protected by law. Also, the Rwanda Correctional Services is in charge of safety and security of prisons, you know, across the country.
Okay. It's just a bit confusing to me. Yesterday, I asked you, and you said pretty clearly that the sanctity of all of Mr. Rusesabagina's communications have been protected, yet on the tape, you very clearly say that legal documents have been examined. How do you account for the difference between what you said yesterday and what you're saying to me now?
What I say to you, I say legal documents, communication between lawyer and client is protected. And I repeat that.
No, but you also said that they hadn't been read. Yesterday you said that the sanctity hadn't been violated and that the government didn't look at the documents. The prison is part of the government. You are a government official. The government has looked at his documents. Did you misspeak? Would you like to correct that?
Well, let me say this. I also said that the correctional service, and I said it to you also, the correctional service is an autonomous institution. When you call it government, I don't understand exactly where you are heading to. It's not the correct thing to say that what they find, what they in their correctional services.
Are you a government official, sir? Are you a government official?
Yes, I am.
And they report to you. You supervise them, right?
Yeah, but the law empowers them to do certain things.
You're a government official and you supervise the prison, but you're saying the prison isn't connected to the government? The prison's how can it be autonomous if they report to you?
I mean, if they're autonomous, that means the law gives them certain powers and what to do and what not to do and when. That's what I'm saying. And they're not supposed to communicate to me what they do in terms of the work they do for safety and security unless it requires any involvement of any other institution.
All right. And when you looked at the communications of Mr. Rusesabagina and his attorney and found no security concerns, you then left it alone?
Yes, of course.
But you looked at it.
Yes, of course. They would.
Right. But my point is the fact that you looked at it is the problem. If the autonomous institution doesn't need anyone to look at it, if there's no problem, and yet you looked at it, then that suggests that he is being looked at. When yesterday you told me they were not, sir. That's the only thing that I'm not able to reconcile.
Excuse me. You are talking about you like this ministry. And I'm telling you that the Correctional Service is an autonomous institution.
Okay.
It does its job of safety and security. And once that is done, they do not have any power to divulge what they see or what they, even in packages, they get packages and have to inspect those packages.
Understood. I understand you clearly, sir. Let's move on. At the center of this story is the fact that Mr. Rusesabagina ended up arrested in Rwanda after boarding a plane that he believed was bound for Burundi. How this happened has been somewhat of a mystery, which I asked you about earlier this week. But I want to play a clip of what you said to your advisors about this, which was, again, somewhat different. Let's look.
Is it news that Rwanda paid for the plane? I've seen it suggested. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen a government person confirm that. And bits of hard information that you may be the first person to say, I'd be cautious about that, because he's looking for something that they could put out a press release about the interview or whatever, so mm-hmm. they'll be looking for nuggets of hard stuff. But I think...
So you thought I should have, for example, said I have no idea who paid?
You do know who paid for the plane that transported Mr. Rusesabagina to Rwanda. The conversation you had with your advisors was whether or not disclosed it. Who did? Tell me who did.
Yeah, but did I tell you yesterday that I don't know who paid?
I'm asking who paid?
The government paid.
So the government paid for the plane that transported him. Yesterday in our conversation, what you suggested to me,
yeah.
if I understand you correctly, was that the government didn't play a role in transporting, in getting him here, right?
I told you, listen to me, I told you that there is a person who was operating with Rusesabagina for a long time, who was an interest of our public investigation, criminal investigation department, who accepted to turn him in, and the payment was to facilitate the transportation of that man, but it was to facilitate the plan of this man to transport Rusesabagina to Rwanda. The government did not play a role in transporting him. It was facilitating this gentleman who wanted to bring him to Rwanda.
So essentially, the government paid for someone else to trick Mr. Rusesabagina to come into Rwanda?
Yes.
And you acknowledge that Mr. Rusesabagina did not know that he was coming into Rwanda. He was tricked, and you're saying the government did not organize the plan. They simply paid for the plane that got him there.
Well, he was brought into Rwanda by someone who lured him to come to Rwanda, who knew exactly what was going on his way. Of course, if he hadn't come here, he was on his way to Burundi, but he was transported to Rwanda by that gentleman, and Rusesabagina himself is aware.
On a plane that the government paid for. So, in light of that, now that you've had a moment to reflect on this, the government paid for a plane that led to the transport of someone without their knowing and certainly against their will into a country that they're not citizens of for the purpose of a legal proceeding. Can you see how that would be seen as an illegal extradition process?
Let me say that one of the things that I intend not to go deeply into is this matter, because it is a matter for the court. And as I told you yesterday, I want to be cautious about what I'm doing, what I say as Attorney General, because it might become, interpreted as influencing the court process. But let me tell you that in international criminal law, luring people into places where they can be brought to justice has happened, and has happened in many other jurisdictions.
Is it legal?
Yes, it is.
So you're saying that this does not violate the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance. You're saying that this does not violate the conventions against torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. You're saying no international law has been violated in what happened of getting Mr. Rusesabagina from Dubai into Rwanda. Is that your position?
I wouldn't want to make conclusions in that direction because, again, as I told you, I don't want to be quoted as interfering in a court process.